May it please the court. This case is on transfer from the Eastern District. The court transferred it based on the impact of formal opinion 126 by the advisory committee that it raised a general issue of interest and importance that should be addressed by this court.
What is the authority of the advisory committee to either give a shield or a what's their authority to do anything? I mean, what authority is there to their opinion?
Basically, the opinion is, I guess before I even answer that question, the advisory committee is based of attorneys as well as, and then they're going to give these opinions.
And lay people.
Lay people, to give these opinions on specific issues that are requested by attorneys on ethical issues. And in this case, they were asked about the ethical position of an attorney who was going to ask a client to waive post-conviction rights in order to receive a plea agreement, a reduced sentence, or anything like that. And so, in this case, in this opinion, that's what they were asked. They were asked whether
they have no rulemaking authority. They, at least in this situation, they have no rulemaking authority. This opinion's not a rule. It's not published anywhere for a comment. What authority is there to their opinion?
I guess first of all, it is a committee of this court, and so it would be have at least sort of a binding, not really
binding. Not a committee of this court, it's a committee appointed by this court, but not it's not a committee of the Supreme Court.
That's correct, and basically it's just somebody giving an opinion on what
they're good people to do in good work. I'm not taking anything away from
this. This is a formal opinion. This is a formally issued opinion. It's not an informal advice to in an individual case. This is one of the few formal opinions issued by the advisory committee.
What about the fact that this opinion really didn't cite the contrary authority in the case decisions that suggested that it was appropriate?
Well,
does that undermine confidence in the opinion?
I don't believe so. I think that even before this opinion came out, there were two cases, Taylor and Gridline, that were Western District cases that talked about the inherent conflict of interest that that appears when an attorney represents a client in the direct appeal as well as the post-conviction motion. So even before this opinion came out, I believe that the Missouri law was clear that there was an inherent conflict and that prejudice should be presumed, and that this opinion was basically bolsters or corroborates those two opinions by the Western District. What I was planning on doing was actually arguing a little bit about the waiver itself before I got into the 126 opinion. Basically, in this case, Mr. Burgess signed a written waiver before the plea, but then actually at the plea, he was asked, did he understand, and he didn't. And he told the court that, and then the court had a brief off-the-record discussion, which we don't know what was really said there, and then he came back on the record at the plea and then did say that he was that he understood, and they proceeded with the plea. Just looking at the written waiver, he was required to waive any claims of ineffective assistance of trial and appellate counsel. He was required to waive any claim that the plea court imposed the sentence without jurisdiction.
Required, but he signed it, or he acknowledged it. The agreement, didn't he?
He did. And the third one, though, of why this waiver should be ruled invalid is that he was required to waive that the sentence imposed was, or any sentence imposed maximum of this, of the possible sentence. And just based on the plain reading of it, he was waiving that seems to me at least an unconscionable contract, that he has to waive something that is unconstitutional. That
if when you plead bargain, you're waiving a jury trial, which is as constitutional as there is, and they're giving you the right to waive the jury trial.
You're correct, but I still think on something like this, where you're waiving the possibility of an illegal sentence.
You mean, for instance, if the statute said 10 years is the maximum sentence, you couldn't waive the 10 years and be sentenced to 100 years. That waiver would be invalid.
Exactly.
What would have been his sentence if he had not waived it? What would have been the other option?
Well, the mandatory minimum was 15 years. That's what he got. And then he could have gotten as high as a life sentence.
It was never articulated that if you don't waive this, the prosecutor was going to recommend something higher? It
wasn't real clear in the plea transcript what other deals or, you know, what the plea negotiations were about.
Well, it only went to the position of the prosecuting attorney. And that is, if he didn't waive, then the prosecutor would not recommend suspended execution sentence and the probation. Now, what the judge would do, none of this was binding on the judge or imposed by the judge.
Exactly. Yeah, it was a plea agreement. I guess if he would have pled blind or something like that, but in here, he pled pursuant to this agreement.
And the other point, I suppose, is that one of the points that the formal opinion 126 addresses is that this waiver would be specifically in part for the benefit of the defense counsel, who would then not be accused, if you want to put it that way, of inadequacy or unconstitutional representation.
That's correct.
So that is it's not that he would be agreeing to something that was illegal. It's that the attorney would be urging him to sign a waiver that takes the attorney off the hook.
Exactly. And as I stated before, the reason why the 126 does apply is that it is a formal opinion, and it is very clear on what in its language that this is not permissible, that it would violate Rule 4-1.7A2, and that the defense counsel certainly had a personal interest in these cases, and that this conflict is not waivable.
But that deals with the ethics between the lawyer and the committee. Okay.
What if he would have sought advice from separate counsel, and separate counsel said, having reviewed the file, having talked to both your lawyer and you, I don't think you're given anything by doing this.
The interesting point, I think that could possibly happen, but that wasn't the facts of this case. But yeah, if you brought in a second set of eyes to review the deal and review the case and everything like that, it's possible.
Other than the embarrassment or awkwardness of having your client accuse you of being incompetent or inadequate, does the attorney have something at stake?
I believe so. I handle post-conviction cases, at the motion court level, and obviously there's the embarrassment, but also if they are found ineffective, there's a potential bar complaint that could possibly be filed, and depending on how egregious the ineffectiveness was, they could possibly be suspended or disbarred.
How often does that happen?
Not often. Not that I know of. I just handle the post-conviction cases that I've handled, and we've never had any, such a proceeding, but I don't know.
If it's an actual conflict, is it waivable?
I don't believe so. Under the formal opinion, it says it's not waivable, but also it seems like, kind of a classic law school hypothetical that you would give to a class and say, can this attorney represent sort of both sides? Because this attorney is not only has the interest of the client to get the best deal that he or she can for the client, but also there's sort of this, did I do a good job? And they're basically litigating their own competency by saying, I have done a good job in your case, if they step into both shoes.
Do you need to show prejudice if something is an actual conflict? I think the state would argue that you have to show some harm resulted to him, that he got bad advice or he waived a real claim.
And I would say that this court can use Taylor and Gridline, because those two cases said that the inherent conflict prejudice was presumed in those cases.
Is it your position that under no circumstances can a defendant waive his right to 24035? Or is there some way, some procedural way it could be handled that a defendant could waive his right to 24035?
I don't think so. I think that the basically then that would gut 24035, and then because that is the procedure for clients to seek post-conviction relief. There's the other procedure, state habeas, but the reason why this rule is out there is to have this collateral review, and if it ever becomes possible to waive this, then I think it basically guts Rule 2435.
What about in the Judge Fisher's posited situation where you have independent counsel advise you as to whether to waive it?
I guess that's possible. I still think that, yeah, you know, having that second set of eyes, it definitely does help. But that kind of rushes that second attorney, because you don't know how long the first attorney has had the case. If, say, they had it for 6 or 8 months, and they're going to go ahead and waive this, and bring in this other attorney, what's the timeline for that attorney? And I just think that would be a really hard standard or something to put on that second attorney.
And you have an underfunded public defender system, and you need to have a pool of attorneys that would be willing to take a fresh look at the case, and that might delay the case. I understand there's practicalities, but I can't see why a separate, there's no conflict with a separate attorney looking at the case.
But basically, I guess I look at that as, that to me as the post-conviction attorney. And if we're going to do that, that's why Rule 2435 is out there. If we're going to throw in this second attorney, that's basically what I do when I, you know, handled Mr. Burgess's case. And so, in a way, the defendant
But
is,
you work for the public defense. I mean, I do. You're all on the same boat. You know, I mean, so one public defender is accused of ineffective, and you end up defending them. I mean, you're the same. You don't have a Chinese wall between you and the other attorneys.
Well, but I also don't think that the waiver, the waiver basically, at the end of a plea, the defendant's asked questions about his representation, and that can actually be kind of served as, we get a lot of times in Rule 2435 that the record has been refuted by what the client has said. And so this waiver doesn't, I don't think, save any work at all, because of the fact that the court is addressing this defendant at the very end of the plea. Yeah, I see that my time is up, and I'll...
I have another question. What significance is the fact that he got the benefit of his bargain, that he got probation and SES and probation, and that he raises this only after he's taken advantage of the bargain?
Well, I guess, first of all, that he did get a benefit of the bargain, but when you look back at the waiver itself, under the opinion 126, I mean, there was this conflict, and the attorney never told him about that conflict. And, you know, maybe he would have changed his mind. Maybe he would have wanted to go to trial and things like that. And so,
But he's taking a position, a different position now in a case than he took previously, after he has benefited from taking that position in the first proceeding.
And that's correct. I mean, he did get a good deal, but that still doesn't take away the fact that there was this conflict that he was not disclosed, or, you know, was not informed about, and able to make a knowing and voluntary decision on the waiver.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court. First of all, as to what effect this formal opinion 126 has, the ethical rules actually state in the preamble parts, they say that they are designed for self-guidance and bar discipline, not as procedural weapons for parties to use in litigation. And an ethics opinion does not carry the ability to overrule court precedent. And obviously the Jackson and Valdez cases out of the...
But are you saying prosecutors should ask, or should be permitted to ask defense counsel to violate the ethics rules?
No, but I'm saying I disagree with the opinion as far as whether or not this violates the ethical rules.
But if that were appropriate ethical, if the court agreed that that was an appropriate advisory opinion, appropriate interpretation of the ethical rules, you're not saying that we could continue to go ahead and have these kind of agreements, and that would be perfectly proper for prosecutors to ask for them and for defense counsel to accept them.
If that opinion is correct and that it's an ethical breach and everything, I think the question would actually be not whether or not the prosecutor could request it. Of course, the prosecutor could, but then the prosecutor would be at great risk for violating their own ethics, and then I think would be subject to discipline.
Okay.
So at that point, yeah, I think that would be a problem.
Is an advisory committee opinion much different than an attorney general's opinion?
You know, I'm not entirely sure.
As far as the weight they carry, I mean, they're binding precedent. That
I would think that they're probably similar. Honestly, I don't know. I haven't researched too much. I feel a little embarrassed about this, but I haven't researched exactly the effects of an attorney general opinion on case law and stuff like that. So I feel a little uncomfortable saying they're exactly the same. But certainly, yeah, it doesn't overrule case law. It, you know, if this court were to say, yes, that an ethics opinion is correct and we adopt it and everything like that, then I think that this court could then overrule Jackson and Valdez if that was this court's prerogative. However, I don't think the ethics opinion standing on its own has that impact. And as far as the Eastern and Western District's opinions in Jackson and Valdez, I think they were right to allow a post-conviction rights waiver, and opinion 126 should not affect those decisions, because there's many benefits to allowing a defendant to waive his post-conviction rights.
But you can't waive an actual conflict of interest, can you?
It's true, and I think that that's one place where the formal opinion goes wrong, is it presumes that this is an actual conflict.
Why is it not an actual conflict of interest for me to say, waive your right to sue me to plead that I was incompetent?
Well, there's a potential conflict here, and I fully admit there's a potential conflict.
It's actually in conflict if I tell you to waive your rights against me, isn't it? How is that just potential?
Well, it's a potential conflict if counsel has done something that causes counsel to be ineffective, that detriments the client, and that then counsel then advises him based upon that knowledge to waive his right to challenge.
Doesn't it benefit counsel just not to have the risk of being claimed to be ineffective? Why does it have to actually be proved in order to...
Because we generally don't entitle people to relief on a potential conflict. They have to show an actual conflict. And here, the appellant has proved, he has pled no facts showing that there was any actual conflict here. The thing is that counsel could have been motivated for a couple different reasons to advise a defendant to waive his post-conviction rights. One, they could be, you know, they could have the ill-conceived motive that is presumed in the ethics opinion.
Inherently, why isn't it telling someone to waive their right to sue you, in effect? Why isn't that inherently a conflict? I assume that counsel most of the time will not have been ineffective, but you don't see an inherent conflict in advising someone whether or not they should waive their right to have a separate counsel look and see if they've been ineffective. I mean, just the benefit of not being subject to that seems to me is a benefit to counsel, which puts them in conflict.
Well, it's a potential benefit. And again, that's the problem, is that we don't know, because the other possible motivation counsel could have for advising a defendant to waive his post-conviction rights is to benefit the defendant, because if he doesn't waive them, then he won't get this great deal from the prosecutor.
Following up with that point, if the defendant could get a better deal by the waiver, now I'm not sure another public defender can, another person employed by a public defender can advise him, but maybe the public defender has a pool of attorneys from Brian Cave or Thompson Coburn or some other firm who would look it over and say, but why should the defendant not benefit from a bargain that they might want to do because of concern about the ethics of the, if they could deal with it, but as Judge Fisher said, get separate counsel. I mean, volunteer lawyers from, again, other not the public defender, volunteer lawyers would look it over and say, you know, this is okay. Why would the defendant not be willing to get a better deal because of the opinion 126?
Well, and I think that's the danger of the opinion, is that by claiming that this is all going to be unethical for both prosecutors and defense counsel, I think the effect is going to be that prosecutors and defense counsel from here on out probably are going to avoid these things, which I think does hurt the defendant, because you take away one of his bargaining chips in plea negotiations.
Counsel, does this take place very often? Is this a very frequent?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. I know that in probably the past year and a half or so, I've seen 6 cases involving a waiver, and this court is going to be addressing another one in Lester Krupp's case, I believe. It hasn't been set yet for argument, but probably in the fall, I would assume it's the same situation, except this one was post-trial, whereas this one's post-guilty plea.
Let me ask you this. Does the record disclose what the attorney advised the client?
The record does not disclose exactly what the attorney advised the client word for word in any way.
We know that the colloquy with the court assured us that Mr. Burgess understood what he was waiving.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if anybody ever asked him, well, did your attorney say this was okay? Because it's entirely possible, isn't it? The attorney said, you know, I don't think you should sign, I don't think you should waive that right to sue me.
It is entirely possible the counsel said that. But, I mean, even if counsel had said that, I think he should still be free to go ahead and make this waiver if that's what
he
chooses.
Well, that's my point. He can make his own decision, but counsel might very well say, or might say, you know, here's the good thing about this deal, here's the bad thing about this deal. I can't tell you whether to take it or not, but I'm going to explain it to you.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Counsel, we don't know what counsel said exactly. Counsel could have said, you know, waive it, knowing that they did something wrong. Or counsel could have said, you know what, I don't really feel comfortable advising you as to this. Here's what the rights are. You know, everything that was outlined in the actual written waiver, I think, is sufficient for him to have waived it, to have entered a knowing and voluntary waiver, according to U.S. Supreme Court in Ruiz.
But did the attorney sign the waiver, too?
I'm sorry?
Did the attorney sign the waiver?
The attorney, plea counsel, the defendant, the prosecutor, and the judge all signed the waiver.
Ms. Woods, can a defendant can they waive their habeas rights?
You know, that's a good question. I haven't looked into that. But I think that here, his was limited to his 2403-5,
but
right?
2403-5 is a codification of habeas. It's in effect, it's taken part of what originally was a defendant's habeas rights and put it into a rule and set procedures around it and said if you don't raise something there, you can't later raise it by habeas. But it is part of what were the original habeas rights.
Well, it's certainly part of post-conviction rights, generally.
Doesn't it? My question, obviously, is if you can't waive habeas, then how can you waive this aspect of habeas?
Well, I think that they are a little different because there's nothing precluding him from still asserting a habeas after this because his waiver is
Well, if it's something you could assert in a 2403-5, you've waived it by not raising it in 2403-5, so there is.
Well, I don't know. I disagree. There's the Clark case that I cited in my brief. I can find it here for a moment. It says, a movement is not totally precluded from litigating ineffective assistance of counsel claims where he does not file a PCR under 2915 or 2403-5 because he arguably could petition for federal post-conviction relief with a petition for federal habeas corpus. And that was an Eastern District opinion out of 2008.
Yeah, but don't they deny it if you didn't raise it when you could have? Then you're procedurally precluded from winning on it, so that's much like not being able to raise it.
I believe that if you could show cause and prejudice for not raising something before, then you might be entitled to relief. And if the situation were, if appellant could approve in this case that counsel was actually operating under conflict, that counsel's decision to advise him to waive was motivated by some ill-gotten gains, and that he suffered prejudice, there was a detriment there to him, then possibly he could show in a habeas action cause and prejudice for why he didn't raise his
post-conviction claims. But for an ethical violation, you don't have to show ill-gotten gain. It's just basically you violated the ethics code.
Well, I think that's my opponent's position. It's just a violation of ethics.
You have to be guided by the ethics code, not get money or any kind of gain from it.
Well, under our conflict rules, in order to show an actual conflict of interest, you have to show that something benefited the one party to the detriment of the other. And so in this case, it would be a benefit to counsel, which presumably would be some avoidance of a finding of ineffective assistance.
Well, if you represent two parties in litigation, you may not benefit one side or the other. You may not get anything for it, but we consider it not being kosher. It's not something that we want to happen.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that brings up a very good distinction between that situation and this situation. There you have a violation of a duty of loyalty to two different clients, whereas here you have a violation of duty of loyalty to one client versus your own self-interest. Those are two different kinds of conflict of interest. And when we're talking about an actual conflict of interest where things like prejudice are presumed under the Kyler versus Sullivan standard, that deals only with multiple or serial representation.
But getting back to what Judge Wolf said also as far as there's a hearing, for example, in a trial, there's often, for example, the client might say, I want to testify no matter what, and the counsel says, no, it won't be good for you to testify. It's a bad idea. I recommend you don't do that, but the client wants to testify anyway and gets impeached and everything. But, you know, that could be something that would have to be put on the record to protect the lawyer from ineffective assistance to counsel when maybe he shouldn't have testified. There's strategy decisions.
Well, and I think that's absolutely right. I mean, a smart attorney would put that on the record to show and protect himself. But again,
and if a client attacks you for ineffective assistance to counsel, that waives the confidentiality, and or at least in that situation, to say, no, I wasn't ineffective. You'd have a chance to say, well, this is what happened. This was the conversation.
Right.
And that's the deal.
Right.
But there was nothing on the record here.
There's nothing in the record as to what exactly was said, but we know that the defendant was well aware of what the 2403-5 rights covered and that he was waiving them by entering into this agreement. There's no question about that. Now, whether he learned it from counsel, whether he learned it from the court, or whether he learned it from this written waiver that he had, he knew exactly what it was that he was waiving, what he was giving up, and that should be sufficient to waive this. And on that note, one of the issues that I take with the opinion is that it says that this is an unwaivable conflict. Now, to the extent that an actual conflict exists here, I don't know why it would be unwaivable, because the unwaivable conflicts, typically those are situations where you have counsel representing opposing parties in litigation. Outside of that, I can't really fathom a situation where it's an unwaivable conflict. I mean, we allow criminal defense
attorneys
to... Well,
we had a recent case of Carlos, the Guatemalan child, where the adopting parents paid for the attorney that was representing the mother. And I think we found that no matter what, how good the representation might have been, it's still so beyond the fall. We got to be perfect.
Those are also two parties that had opposing interests. They each wanted the child.
If you have an actual conflict, by definition, you've decided you have opposing interests. I mean, your argument is that it's not an actual conflict, but once you decide it is, that by definition, they're actually in conflict.
Well, right. If there is an actual conflict, then prejudice is presumed. But the thing is that you can waive a potential conflict. I mean, we allow them to do this all the time. Like, for example, when you have a criminal defense attorney representing co-defendants, they're allowed to waive the potential conflict that might exist there. And we allow them to do that. And I don't see how this is really that much different, because the reason that we don't allow waiver in situations where you have, like, a husband and wife, you know, in a divorce proceeding, we don't allow them to waive that conflict by having the same attorney represent them, is because they are opposing parties in the same litigation. By definition, they have differing interests, even if it's an uncontested divorce. But here, we don't know that counsel and her client had different interests. They might have very well had perfectly aligned interests. And, for example, in the Taylor and Gradine cases that my opponent talked about, those cases both relied on a case out of this court, State versus Powell. And in State versus Powell, that exemplifies why this is only a potential conflict and not an actual conflict. Because in State versus Powell, what we had here was we had a capital defendant being represented by, I believe it was a public defender, and she, for whatever reason, developed some emotional attachment to the defendant. And so then she had filed just, I suppose, an ungodly long motion for a new trial alleging all of these claims of trial court error. Well, then she helped him draft his pro se post-conviction motion. She included every single one of those claims in it, plus dozens of claims claiming that she herself was ineffective. She told the court, I did all the stuff wrong. And this court chastised counsel, not for having a conflict, but for abusing the process. And I think that situation right there just shows you that you can't presume that counsel is obviously going to have adverse interests to her client, because their counsel's interests were obviously very much aligned with her client's, to avoid the death penalty and to avoid the conviction and do whatever she could to help him.
You know, forbearance to sue is a benefit. We find that's consideration. It's a benefit in itself to know that you're not going to be subject to these claims. I don't understand why you have to show you'd win.
I don't know that you're forbearing the right to sue your counsel.
But that's the effect of, I mean,
not necessarily.
It would be a benefit to me were I counsel to know that no one could make a claim against me. I understand your argument that you think you actually have to show you would win the claim, but I'm wondering what you cite for that.
Well, you don't have to show that in order to file a malpractice action against your criminal defense counsel, what you have to show is that you're actually innocent. Now, you don't have to do that through a PCR motion. You can do that through direct appeal.
There was no waiver of the right to sue for malpractice, though.
No, that was not listed among the waivers at all. No. But, you know, one of the prerequisites to being successful in a malpractice action against a criminal defense attorney is you do have to prove your actual innocence. And you generally are precluded from alleging that if you have not been successful in direct appeal.
There's an argument, I assume, for a public defender, you just have sovereign immunity. But the game beyond that, there's the issue of the Fisher solution. I mean, if you have not saying, let's say Scott Rosenblum on the east side and Wench, the Wersch firm on the west side and Wampler, and if you had competent criminal lawyers who would say, call them up and say, I'd like you to look this over, I don't want the client to sign this without you giving independent counsel to the client, that would solve it all.
Well, I think that's certainly an option, but I think also you've got the problem that you've got this other attorneys, you know, they have to be willing to do it. And part of the problem, if you are doing that, then I see I'm out of time. May I go ahead and answer your question?
Yes.
Part of the problem with that is that it would be very time consuming, because that attorney then is, in a sense, forming a client-attorney relationship with the defendant, because they are advising them legally as to the consequences of this waiver. Now, once they form that relationship, that then subjects them to all sorts of ethical problems and dilemmas. And so I think, you know, I mean, what if they miss a valid claim in saying, you know what, I don't see anything here, why don't you go ahead and sign the waiver? But in effect, say there's something very blatantly obvious, like a statute of limitations defense or something like that, then they've now put themselves at risk. So I don't know that we're going to get a second set of eyes to be willing to do this. I you know, it would probably be a good practice, but I don't know if the logistics would work.
If it's wrong for the first attorney to give an opinion that might have a conflict, why wouldn't it be wrong for the second to do it as well?
I agree.
All the way down. Yeah.
Right. But unless there are further questions, I ask that you affirm. Thank you.
And I would also agree with Judge Price on that, that it would, we're just adding layers and layers of attorneys. And
isn't the problem if we do this that we are going to remove a segment of the criminal defense from ever making plea agreements in? Prosecutor will have no interest in making an agreement with a person that they can't get finality.
I agree. I think that's why these waivers, the question was asked, how common are these? And I think when Mr. Burgess's case was coming across, they were common, at least in St. Louis County. And now I don't think they're doing them at all because it's just not worth the hassle and the potential liability because of this formal opinion. And so we're asking this court, I mean, there's a couple options of what it can do. Judge DePriest did not write findings in this case, and probably the easiest solution would be is to find that the waiver was not either valid or that 126 invalidates the waiver, and then send the case back for official findings from Judge DePriest to give him an opportunity to write whatever, you know, whether he's going to grant an evidentiary hearing or not in this particular case.
Did the post-conviction motion allege that counsel gave advice in response to Judge Wolf's question? Did the petition state that defense counsel advised Mr. Burgess that he should enter into this agreement?
It was that they didn't advise him of this conflict. And then Mr. Burgess, we pled that Mr. Burgess would not have pled guilty had he known about this potential or this conflict of interest that was involved. And I don't know if the court...
But is there a conflict if defense counsel didn't render any advice? If he just said, defense counsel said, I'm remaining silent. I'm not going to advise you.
Or advised against it.
I would say that the defense counsel in this case, you know, had a duty to inform the client of the plea agreement and all facets of the plea agreement. So the attorney.
And here's my question, though. How do we know that that did not occur?
We don't, because we didn't have a hearing. I would have asked if we had an evidentiary hearing.
But if all you alleged was that if you alleged a conflict, he either did give advice or he gave no advice or he gave a recommendation. This, can we tell from your motion what your client says he was advised of?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And just a couple seconds left if there aren't any other questions.
Do you have a conflict? If you work for the public defender and the public defender's working for the client, don't you have conflict since you represent the public defender? That's who pays you. If you're representing the 24 or 35, you're got a conflict too, don't you?
I think the way the system...
Just like Judge Wright said, if you have one conflict, it keeps on going as a conflict.
Well, I think the way our system is set up, Mr. Burgess pled in St. Louis County, so there's a public defender's office in St. Louis County that represented him.
But you have one, Kat Kelly is the boss of the whole group.
That's true.
Why isn't she in charge and you report to her and they report to her too?
I guess we are kind of a little separated. I mean,
a little bit. Well, you're a little separated, but you're all paid by the same.
Yes.
What?
You've always had separate offices for post-conviction counsel, and you always have separate people represent defendants in the post-conviction counsel.
But is there no... Okay.
I have one other question. This is a question of first impression for this court, it sounds like. Are there any other states that have adopted your position?
Well, I would say that the state of Missouri did in the Taylor and Gridline case, but as in, you know, these formal opinions, just the ones that were cited in the...
You cited three states which did follow the...
Has case law in other states addressed whether you can waive your post-conviction right?
That's my question.
You can in other states and in some federal courts. I mean, they've said that they can be found enforceable, these waivers.
How do they address the conflict of interest issue?
They didn't, and that's the way that I've kind of couched the argument, is they didn't argue the conflict of interest. They just said that you could waive these rights.
Are there any further questions? Thank you very much. The case is taken under submission.